This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochrane, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Thursday, March 28th. Two more premiers take their case against the carbon tax to Parliament Hill. Just ahead, Premier Danielle Smith is here with her proposal, and the federal government is standing by to respond. Plus, a childcare announcement from the Liberals. Coming up, what today's news means for anxious parents stuck on a daycare waitlist. We begin in Ottawa, where Conservative premiers are urging MPs to stop the upcoming carbon tax hike. In 4 days, the federal price on carbon will increase, as scheduled, from $65 per ton to $80 a ton. That means Canadians will pay about 3 cents more per litre on gasoline. Yesterday, Saskatchewan Premier brought his fight against the tax to a parliamentary committee. Today, New Brunswick Premier Blaine Higgs and Alberta Premier Danielle Smith made their case. Alberta Premier Danielle Smith joins me now. Premier Smith, welcome back to the show.
Hi, David.
So you've made very clear you oppose the carbon tax, very clear you oppose the oil and gas emissions cap. So exactly what federal policies to reduce emissions would you support?
Well, we support working together on carbon capture, utilization, and storage. We put forward our investment tax credit in our most recent budget. We're looking for some clarity around the federal tax credit. Also, the Strategic Investment Fund has been very supportive of several net zero projects that we have in our province for ammonia, for hydrogen, for petrochemicals, even for cement. So those are the kind of things we can work on together. You may have seen we just announced as well the first fueling station for hydrogen. We purchased hydrogen vehicles. We're working with the federal government on hydrogen buses and dual fuel vehicles for transportation. So I would say that we have lots that we can work on together. It's just that, unfortunately, the federal government has set targets that we believe will result in production caps. And we also believe that they're unachievable. So we're still working through some of those.
Okay, the things you agree on and are working together on are helpful, but they're not going to get the whole job done. If you look at the international climate targets that Canada and other countries have agreed to. And if you look at the retail carbon tax, according to the analysis by the Climate Institute, that's 14% of emission reductions by 2030. The emissions cap on oil and gas is another 34% in emissions reductions by 2030. If Canada scraps those, that's nearly half of the emissions reductions that it has booked in its modeling. So how do you fill that gap? How do you replace that?
Well, I can tell you what I'm seeing is that in our energy, in our Pathways Group, which is our oil sands production, they're looking at carbon capture utilization storage for a part. They're looking at small modular nuclear for a part. They're looking at direct air capture as another piece. If you look as well at our electricity industry, they're looking at the same thing. And then there's also the incredible opportunity that we have to work through Article 6 of the Paris Accord to get emissions reductions internationally and get them credited back here. We know that Japan and South Korea and India would all like to do dual combustion with ammonia into their existing coal fired stream to be able to reduce emissions. There's the replacement of coal with natural gas. All of those things are going to be able to allow us to reduce international emissions, which we could also get some offset credit for here. So I'm very optimistic that we'll be able to reach our targets.
Right, but this is half of what's booked right now. This is half of the plan. And so counting on Article 6, which a lot of people criticize as kind of magical thinking, because if India uses Canadian technology or Canadian resources to reduce its emissions, India is going to want credit. It's not going to cede that credit back to Canada, right? So like, how do we domestically deal with 50% of our emissions if you get rid of the retail carbon tax and don't go ahead with an oil and gas emissions cap? What is the plan to hit the target?
Well, I can tell you, like, even the environment minister has said that the carbon tax isn't going to have the effect that he's hoping for until 2060. And I guess that's really the question for the environment minister. I've mentioned four projects in Alberta that will be net zero as soon as they're completed, major industrial projects. So we don't even have to wait until 2050 for those projects. But meanwhile, I'm trying to understand what he thinks he's doing by taxing individuals, taking a cut through the bureaucracy at the federal level, rebating a portion back. I mean, that's not going to cause people to take on zero emissions vehicles. It's not going to allow them to put solar panels on their roofs. It's not going to allow them to adopt a geothermal system in their homes. So there isn't really any connection between the carbon tax and the practical things that need to be done if you're going to reduce emissions. So I would question whether or not it's going to be successful at all.
Well, the modeling, though, attributes up to 14% of the reductions to carbon pricing, because people at the higher end of the economic ladder who are paying it and not necessarily getting the rebate, the people at the bottom of the economic ladder are getting, can make those choices and change their behavior because they have the means and thereby reduce their carbon hit. I mean, that's the whole point of it. It's price signals through the market.
Well, look, I don't exist in a computer model. I exist in the real world. And in the real world, to get a net zero power grid in our province, we're going to have natural gas come on stream to be able to support increased adoption of solar and wind because it's a backup. That natural gas is going to have carbon capture utilization and storage at the very best available technology, which will keep on improving. We're going to see our citizens increasingly adopt zero emissions vehicles, whether it's electric in the big cities or whether it's hydrogen in heavy equipment and in rural areas. And we're also going to take the time to go through the regulatory process to adopt small modular nuclear, which I'm told will probably take until about 2035. In addition, we have funded a whole variety of projects on hydrogen, on bitumen beyond combustion, as well as on geothermal and direct air capture that I think will fill out the other piece. So I think I'm of the view that you need to make the technology available and the products available for consumers to be able to buy them. That has to come first. If you don't have those products available, then a carbon tax is just punitive. People are upset because they have an increase in the cost of everything they pay for and no real practical way to be able to transition to different fuels.
But Premier, we have this dynamic that's evolving right now. I mean, the political dynamic between the federal conservatives and the federal liberals is what it is. But on this debate about the future of climate policy in the country, we have politicians saying the carbon tax is too punitive, it doesn't reduce emissions, and it needs to go without presenting an alternative. And you have economists and environmentalists who have worked on this for decades saying it's the least costly way to deal with this, and here is the evidence that it is working, and there is no cheaper as effective replacement. So why should Canadians believe politicians over people who have devoted their lives to working in this particular field?
Well, because I would just point to the fact that Dow Chemical is doing a $10 billion investment project with Linde that has is world-renowned. They've got 50 projects of taking hydrogen and being able to capture the CO2. And that is going to be in operation in 2028. I don't think that exists in any computer model. I don't think Inter Pipeline and their ammonia production, where they capture the CO2, put it underground, export it to Japan or South Korea so that they can reduce their carbon stream in their coal plants. I don't think that's in a computer model. And I don't think that the build-out of our hydrogen economy, which is well underway in Alberta, we're one of the biggest producers of hydrogen, I don't think that's in the computer model either. So all I can tell you is what I see with my own eyes that are going to have an immediate impact on doing a massive reduction in emissions and what I'm seeing with the carbon tax. With the carbon tax, we're giving a dollar to Ottawa. They're giving us back 75 cents with $400 every couple of months. That's just going to pay for the extra cost of everything. It's not doing any meaningful transition to reduce CO2 emissions. So it's a bit of a shell game. People see it, they don't like it, and they would like to see us invest in the technology to be able to achieve the outcome and deal with the very serious affordability crisis that we have in the immediate term.
Okay, on the affordability crisis, if you look at the math, though, that was done by the Parliamentary Budget Officer, I'm speaking strictly on the fiscal analysis of what you pay versus what you get in rebates. On a straight cash-in, cash-out analysis, roughly 80% of Canadians get back more than they pay in the carbon tax, and the net benefits for low-income Canadians is even higher still. It's significant there, and that's especially true in Alberta. That's about a 3% boost in household income for low-income Albertans. So how is that not helping with the affordability crisis? Because if you get rid of the carbon tax, you get rid of the carbon rebate.
Well, it's got to be one or the other. I mean, is the tax there to cause people to make the investments that I talked about, which are multi-thousand dollar investments, or is it there as some kind of income redistribution scheme? And if you're going to argue as an income redistribution stream, then I guess I would have to argue that it doesn't go back to small businesses. The small businesses are going, they don't get the rebate. They just pay the tax, and then they have to work that into the price of all the goods that they have, and it gets passed on to customers. That's why the economic impact matters as well, is because you get a portion of it rebated to you, but then the price of everything you pay for ends up going up, which increases inflation. And when inflation goes up, then the Bank of Canada says, sorry, we can't cut your rates. And when your rates don't get cut, then when you go to renew your mortgage, that's also more expensive. So I think that they're creating a greater inflation crisis. It'd be so much easier if they just said, hey, look, we recognize oil prices are going higher again. This is a big cost. We'll take that entire 17 cents a liter off while oil prices are high because we know it's going to have an impact on you. That's what we did in Alberta. We gave $2.3 billion of relief over 2 years to do exactly that. And if the federal government wants to follow our model, that's what we do. When the rates are low, we end up having the tax back on. When the rates are high, we take them off so that we can give a bit of a break to people. And it works. Last year, we had the lowest level of inflation in the country. This year, with Scott Moe not collecting the carbon tax, he's got the lowest inflation rate in the country.
But the Bank of Canada, Premier, the Bank of Canada never cites carbon pricing as a reason for raising or holding rates. It's always international factors. It's always supply chain issues. It is increasingly provincial governments putting a lot of money into the pockets of their citizens and driving buying power. It's not carbon pricing. And Tiff Macklem has said that the direct effect of it is like 0.15%. The knock-on effect is 0.03%. We're talking 15 to 30 cents on $100. This is not the reason inflation and interest rates are high. It's a bunch of other factors, right? So isn't carbon pricing being kind of scapegoating here as the reason behind the inflation and affordability crisis when it's not the driving issue?
All I know is last January, when we had rebates for electricity, when we had rebates on fuel taxes, when we had our other affordability measures, we had the lowest inflation in the country. This year, with Scott Moe taking the fuel tax off of natural gas, he's got the lowest inflation rate in the country. So something else is going on there. Maybe the modeling is not taking into account all factors. I think it just stands to reason that when you have higher costs of energy, and energy goes into heating warehouses and transporting food, and all of those additional costs for gasoline and diesel and heating, it's going to increase the cost of goods. I think it's fairly obvious to most people that the cost of living goes up when those kinds of costs go up.
Okay, well, I maybe, but that's not what the Bank of Canada is saying, and that's not what a lot of the economic modeling is saying, at least the role the carbon price is playing in with this. But just as a final point, Premier, I mean, if you get what you want, I know on April 1, your gas tax is going back up because of a drop in oil prices. You need that revenue to help with your budget. That's going to stack on top of the carbon tax increase. If you get what you want and this goes away at the federal level, and if you get what you want and the emissions cap goes away, then everyone's kind of counting on industry to do this without sort of federal pressure and a price signal that compels them or creates incentive for them to act in a way or face financial penalty. Doesn't that just amount to Canada lowering its ambition when it comes to emissions reduction? Because the consensus among economists is that pricing is the best way to do it and everything else, technology regulation, is more expensive, more intrusive, and not as effective as creating incentive for big polluters to change.
Well, I'll take a difference of approach with the retail carbon tax, which I don't feel consumers can avoid, and it just becomes an extra cost for them, versus industrial pricing, which we have done since 2007. And in fact, our TIER program, it's our technology innovation and emissions reduction approach, we put a price on industrial carbon. Those companies that are performing better than average get a credit, which they can sell on the market. Those that are performing worse than average have to pay into a fund. We've had them pay over $2 billion into that fund that go into emissions reduction technologies. And our program has been affirmed by the federal government to be equivalent to the approach that they wanted to take until 2030. So we're going to continue with that approach because we see that it's working, but we need it to be at the provincial level. We certainly don't want to see the federal government take it over, and that's why we're going to continue to fight against it. But industrial pricing is a different ballgame because those are the companies that do have the billions of dollars to invest in the technological change. But we shouldn't be hurting seniors, those on fixed income, those who are vulnerable by having the price of everything they pay for continue to go up with these carbon taxes that they simply can't avoid.
Premier Daniel Smith, thanks again for your time today.
You bet. Thank you.
All right, as we just heard, there is opposition to the federal carbon price from premiers across the country.
We can all agree with party on we don't like the carbon tax.
I think it's creating a national unity crisis.
There's other ways of reducing emissions other than digging into people's pockets.
So far, seven premiers have called on Ottawa to halt the planned April 1 increase. Three of them have testified before a parliamentary committee, putting the federal government on the defensive over its signature climate policy. Jonathan Wilkinson is the Minister of Energy and Natural Resources, and he joins me now. Minister, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Daniel Smith is one of three premiers who have testified at a committee this week, with maybe more to come, pushing back against this April 1 carbon price increase. What's your reaction to what appears to be a concentrated effort to create pressure on your government to change course?
Well, I mean, look, it's obviously a pretty thinly veiled partisan effort on the part of Mr. Polyev and a number of conservative premiers. You know, this week was actually an important week, and it was an important week in part because of the letter that 200 economists from across the country came together to actually say these are the experts on these issues, that carbon pricing is the least cost alternative to reduce carbon emissions. They are an important part of Canada's climate plan, and that the way in which it's structured is done in a manner where 8 out of 10 Canadian families get more money back, and in fact, it's those that are most vulnerable that get the most money back. So we have a bunch of politicians who have zero background in these issues, and we have 200 economists who actually are experts in the field. I mean, at the end of the day, I put my weight with the 200 economists.
Okay, I take your point on that, and I have the letter in front of me, and I've read it, but we've seen from some of these economists who do support carbon pricing as the best and most effective way to do this, as you say. Also, very unhappy with the carve-out for home heating oil that your government has done, and the fact that the policy, some of them object that it's not entirely just driven by pricing. There's a mix of regulations and other things there. But the criticism on the carve-out, they say you've undermined the value of carbon pricing and the argument that it is not an economic hardship for people at the bottom of the income ladder. What do you say to that criticism?
Well, certainly I have a lot of respect for a lot of the people that have written, you know, in that letter. I obviously have a bit of a different view on the heating oil exemption, and it's not actually an exemption. It's a pause for a very specific period of time. It is very different from other ways in which you heat your home. It's 3 to 4 times as expensive as natural gas. It has escalated significantly in the last couple of years. It creates enormous affordability challenges for people who live on heating oil, most of whom, or many of whom, live in energy poverty. And so what we had said was, you can put in place heat pumps that actually will save people thousands of dollars a year, but most people who actually have heating oil as their source of heat in their homes can't afford to actually put that money up front. So we basically said we will pause it during the period in which we're actually implementing heat pumps so that within 3 years there will be an opportunity for people to actually save a ton of money. And so it is quite different from other forms of heating. At the end of the day, folks who actually heat with natural gas are getting more money back than they pay in the price associated with that. That wasn't true for people on home heating oil.
I was one of the people in St. John's who had an oil tank on their house. I've heated with oil, so I've paid the price firsthand, though certainly I've had, you know, good employment my whole life, so I wasn't at that lower end of the income ladder where you would have those struggles. But why not find a way to increase the rebates for people there so you keep the pricing system whole while you also work on the heat pump program? Because this carve-out, this pause, as you call it, it's being weaponized against your entire policy right now.
Well, as I say, I think the heating oil issue is a very specific issue. We have said that we've addressed affordability concerns generally with respect to the price on pollution, and that 8 out of 10 families get more money back, and that is just true. The data is true, and anybody who says that it's not true is lying to you. Like, Pierre Polyev is lying to Canadians, which is a very unbecoming thing for the leader of the official opposition to do. But that wasn't true with heating oil. It was a one significant exception, and at a time where people, and particularly people who are living on lower incomes are struggling, what we said was we will pause the price, we will implement heat pumps, we will pay for the implementation such that you will then be able to actually save money on a go-forward basis. But it's a very different circumstance than everybody else who actually is getting more money back.
We spoke to the parliamentary budget officer last week on the day of the confidence vote on the April 1 carbon price increase to sort of get him to walk us through his findings that the conservatives are using to say this carbon policy is hurting people, and which your government is using to say shows that people are actually getting more back than they pay in. And in some ways, both are true, right? On a pure financial cash out, cash in, 80% people get back more than they pay. But when you factor in the economic dampening caused by bringing in carbon pricing, economically, it does have an impact. Now, I know that doesn't assess the cost of climate change. It doesn't assess the alternatives to carbon pricing and the economic impacts they would have. How do Canadians walk through that, though, when you have one report with two different conclusions and a bunch of other contextual issues that are not factored into this analysis, but it's being boiled down to very simple explanations in the political arguments that are happening?
Well, this is the difficulty of politics in the modern age, where everything, often complicated issues, are sort of 30-second sound bites. But I would say to you, the one conclusion that is a full conclusion is that cash in, cash out, 8 out of 10 Canadians get more money back. That's just true. The other part of it, which is what is the effect on economic growth going forward? All the PBDO did was assess the impact of the price on pollution. But as you've seen, including in the letter from The Economist, every other way to reduce carbon emissions is actually more expensive. So you would see that the numbers associated with the dampening are far higher if you did regulation or if you just did massive investment. And the other alternative is you just do nothing to fight climate change. And then you've got to actually look at what are the costs associated with just not doing anything about climate change. And those are going to be astronomical. So, I mean, the Conservative Party can mislead Canadians all they want, but the PBO's fundamental finding is that 8 out of 10 Canadians get more money back.
Well, when you look at where the mood has shifted, I don't know if Canadians feel the way they feel because of the affordability challenges caused by interest rates, inflation, you know, the global effects on the food supply chain, which has driven up the price of groceries, or if they're believing the argument that you say is dishonest from the Conservatives, and certainly a lot of economists say it's dishonest from the Conservatives. But the mood has definitely shifted, Minister, right? I mean, how worried are you, as a guy who's worked on this and championed this for even before you got into politics, that just social license for this particular policy is, if not gone, it's significantly eroded and is very fragile at this point in time?
Well, I think that this is a conversation that we need to engage in a fulsome way with Canadians. At the end of the day, it is not sufficient for Pierre Poilievre and Conservative premiers to just complain. We need to be asking them, what is your alternative? What is your alternative to address climate change? And if the alternative on Poilievre's position is that he doesn't believe in climate change or he just isn't going to do anything about it, then he should be honest with Canadians about that. But right now, he is lying to Canadians about the facts. There are no facts that support what he is saying. And he has no plan to address the climate issue. His plan, effectively, is to let the planet burn for future generations. That's not responsible, and that's a conversation I'm happy to engage on a broad basis across this country.
So at committee today, I'm dealing with questions about affordability for Canadians. The New Democrats have proposed this other option that I'm sure you're aware of, removing the GST, removing the HST and the blended jurisdictions from all home heating fuels to give people a break while cost of living numbers remain high, even as inflation decelerates. I know you want to stick with the purity of carbon pricing from this point on. Is that something you think the government will consider as a measure to help deal with pocketbook challenges for Canadians while preserving the integrity of your emissions reduction plan?
Well, certainly addressing affordability concerns are top of mind for the Government of Canada. We have been working to try to address some of the challenges that were caused by supply chain disruptions coming out of COVID and the inflation that we saw as a result of it. And, of course, some of the interest rate issues that are now facing Canadians who have mortgages as we try to actually, Bank of Canada tries to temper inflation, which it has been doing quite successfully. And we've done that all the way along. I mean, the grocery rebate and the workers' benefit, but also programs like childcare, like what I was announcing today, building out affordable childcare, that will save in Saskatchewan, where I am. I'm in Regina. It will save families $6,900 per year per child. Like, those are structural ways in which to address affordability. We are certainly going to continue to work on that. It is extremely important that we are addressing the concerns that are on the minds of Canadians who have gone through these challenges over the last couple of years. I will tell you, I was in Germany last week meeting with the Vice Chancellor, and I was previous to that in a number of other G7 countries. I mean, this is an issue in all of the G7 where people have come through some very challenging times, and governments need to be there to ensure that we are doing what we can to support them with affordability, and we are doing that.
Jonathan Wilkinson, Minister of Energy and Natural Resources, thanks for your time today, sir.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so in trying to convince Canadians that they do have the better agenda, the government is rolling out measures in the upcoming 2024 budget early. And today's announcement is aimed at helping to increase the number of child care workers and affordable daycare spaces.
This $1 billion in investment in child care is going to make a huge difference in the number of spaces right across the country.
Okay, it hasn't gone smooth, though. And when asked whether all provinces were holding up their end of the child care deals, the Prime Minister said this.
Conservative premiers are in some cases slow walking and in some cases not delivering to the right level because they're listening to their federal brethren. This government is here to ensure that everyone across the country starts getting better access to affordable, high quality child care.
Okay, there's a couple of things there. It's the rollout of budget policies in advance of the budget, but also the lumping together of challenges at the provincial level with the federal Conservatives. So I want to talk about that with the power panel. Cameron, let's start with you. Budget leaks, they're the new jam, I guess, in Ottawa. They're just going to roll out policy announcements day after day after day in the run-up to the April 16th document. What do you make of the strategy, and what do you make of the tactic there of lumping issues and Fed-Prov relations in with intransigence from the federal Conservatives in the House of Commons?
Well, lots to say on this one. I'll start by saying I really love it and kind of wish I did this when I was there. It's really hard to get your message out. I'm sure everyone, especially Matthew and James, will agree, it's hard to get your message out on budget day, because just the tradition and the system, the way it's done, is really quite complex. You've got people locked up in a room for hours. You've got hundreds of pages worth of announcements that you have to fit into a frame, into a narrative, and you have to compete with opposition voices and analysts in a few hours in the evening, and then try and maintain consistency over your rollout in the weeks that follow. This is such a great way to shine a spotlight on some good concrete policies early on, build up your frame into the budget, and explain, you know, in a much more sustained way what you're doing, and get people aware of some of the specific things you're working on. So I love the strategy. I also love to see how pumped up the PM is. I mean, he's clearly rolled up his sleeves and excited about these things. And in terms of, you know, framing the or lumping the premiers in with the federal Conservatives, there's been some talk lately of childcare spaces, and you covered this on your show, you know, childcare commitments or targets not being met in some provinces. Well, in some provinces they are, like in BC, you were hearing them rattle off some of the amazing statistics of thousands of people who've gotten access to spaces, the price is going down, they're making so much progress. That's because they're working in partnership. The federal government has put huge amounts of money on the table to get childcare spaces available and prices down across the country. It's working in some places. The premiers of the provinces where it's not meeting the targets have to answer for that. And this is an amazing policy that is super concrete, because people can feel, you know, young parents can feel thousands of bucks that they're saving every year. It's kind of outrageous how much childcare spaces can cost in some parts of this country. And again, great contrast with the Conservatives, because are they going to cut this program? Do they still think it's a slush fund, like Pierre Poilievre said a while back? Or do they just not believe that this is good for the economy when, again, it's proven that it is?
So, Shachi, I know there have been some challenges in British Columbia with this, largely to do with, like, cost of living for early childhood educators, you know, in the greater Vancouver area and the lower mainland, physical space and rent costs, not a lack of buy-in from the provincial government. But, you know, there have been growing pains on this program, but this strategy of highlighting specific things in advance, I mean, Paul Martin used to do a little bit of this. I saw some of this with provincial governments in Newfoundland and Labrador. Is this a way to connect sort of like smaller line items in the budget with Canadians in a way that would just get washed in the normal sort of budget rollout?
Yeah, as a former reporter who's been in a number of budget lockups over the years, the fire hose that you're drinking from, the capriciousness of the assignment desk around what they want you to focus on, and just the sheer amount of information volume and math and budgeting that you've got to follow and report back and really pull out what is important. Look, the Liberal government is showing, Justin Trudeau is showing, that he now understands the assignment. If the assignment is doing a better job of communicating with Canadians about the things that he wants to talk about. They were caught completely short on housing and really sort of forced to then react and react in a very vocal way. Same thing around carbon pricing. Caught asleep at the switch, starting to see the numbers really moving in the wrong direction for them in the face of just relentless opposition. So what they're trying to do is clearly change the dynamic and get out ahead in front of it first, particularly with constituents who are feeling most squeezed on cost of living and most harassed. And that's parents. That's middle-aged Canadians who are raising children in need of that childcare space, but also paying a mortgage, facing mortgage renewal, as 60% of mortgage holders are facing in the next little while, and really just saying, hey, we're doing this. Now, of course, the challenge is always between now and April 16th, the critics have more time to come out, nitpick against it, sharpen their their message. But this is clearly a sign this government is taking the communications assignment more seriously and really trying to elbow and carve out some space for themselves. The fact that we are talking about this today shows that is, for this government, a step in the right direction. The big question is it going to make a difference?
So James Shachi talks about getting the assignment. It seems to me the assignment for the Liberals, from my amateur perch here, is they need to match the permanent campaign footing that Pierre Poilievre is on. And that's a bit what this looks like right now, at least in the early stages. It's almost like a platform release leading up to the budget and then backing it up with sort of campaign-style events, because that's what Pierre Poilievre is doing so effectively every day.
Well, that's really all it is, right? It's,
yeah.
it's a full-blown campaign, and it's picking a fight. And by the way, he'll, as time goes on, as we get closer to summer and closer to the American election, he'll not just rope in, you know, conservative politicians, as you know, typified by the premiers across the country, but conservative politicians. He'll go after Donald Trump and try to lasso everybody in with sort of belligerent rhetoric and sort of cast everybody as having, is sort of drinking from the same fountain and having the same views. It's to type. But it's interesting how, you know, on issue after issue, whether it's childcare, dental care, a price on carbon, pharmacare, that on issue after issue, he's going into areas that are predominantly provincial jurisdiction and poking at provinces and demanding that they put more money on the table. You have the province of Ontario yesterday put forward a bigger spending budget than has ever been seen before in the province of Ontario, but it's still not enough, still chastising, still poking. And so he's trying to pick a fight. And this is a clear contrast from what he promised when he became prime minister in 2015, where he would have a collaborative effort. We will work, you know, sunny ways. We'll work with the provinces. We'll collaborate and get things done. No, he wants to pick fights. He wants to pick fights with people he doesn't like for his own advantage, rather than actually get things done. And it's, again, to Cameron's point, good politics. He's animating the base. That's fine. Whether the outcomes will be seen, because on all those issues, the policies are all half-baked. Very little has been delivered, but the fight is there on the prime minister. So if you want to see Justin Trudeau animated and fighting, you've got it. Clear policies and deliverables with partners who have to be there with you to deliver it. It seems like you'd rather fight with the provinces than work with them.
Matthew, is that how you see this? I mean, today was like loan forgiveness, student loan forgiveness for early childhood educators. The feds can do that on their portion of loans. A program to help with the expansion of daycares. But, you know, to James' larger point, you see there being conflict baked into this strategy.
I think that's part of it. And I think I think they're going to struggle with it a little bit, because I think, you know, you hear this back and forth about who's responsible, you know, all these problems that Canadians are concerned about. You know, think of things like healthcare, for example, and how much of that rests at the feet of the premiers. But at the end of the day, it's not untrue that people don't, you know, sort of regular people, if I can use that phrase, don't care about jurisdiction. They just want the problem solved. That's true. At the same time, that same lack of care or understanding in some cases of who's responsible for it also means that it makes it challenging when you don't have the result that you want. So you look at the renter's bill of rights thing that they, you know, approach that they want to have. If there's not buy-in from the provinces and there's no net result from that, then ultimately you've put yourself out there for something that depends on negotiating an outcome with the provinces. So in some places like British Columbia, the childcare example might be great for them because things are moving along, they're making additional investments. But in other places like Alberta, it might pose a challenge where the provincial government is lagging behind.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately, you know, we talked about the campaign aspect to it. That's certainly part of it. That's why the sleeves were rolled up. That's why there's excitement. Mm-hmm. But I think it also allows them to double dip a little bit on some of this stuff leading into budget season and repeat it again. Because the budget, for all the hoopla around it, it's ultimately a political document. It's the things that happen around it that are actually enacting it. So.
But, you know, Matthew, they've never gotten a real big bounce out of any of the budgets. And they are determined not to let this. It might be their last one or their second last one, right?
For sure. And
before the election.
And hopefully that's part of what they're trying to address here, because there's been a real lack of narrative. Mm-hmm. I mean, you look at even someone like Sean Fraser, who's doing yeoman's work out there talking about housing, but it feels so disconnected from the overall government. That's a real challenge they have right now.
Okay, gang, we got to say goodbye. I want to thank you all. Shachi Curl, James Moore, Cameron Ahmad, Matthew Dubé. Okay, we're going to focus now on the U.S. election, because in just over 7 months, Americans will vote for president. And barring any stunning developments, it will be a Joe Biden versus Donald Trump rematch. And the race, it's close. Some polls show Trump in the lead. Biden touched down in New York City today, along with former President Barack Obama. They'll join another former president, Bill Clinton, tonight for a major fundraiser. It's expected to bring in $25 million, potentially the most lucrative fundraising event in American political history. Meanwhile, Trump is facing mounting legal bills as the many civil and criminal cases brought against him progress through the courts. Now, the former president is selling $60 Bibles. None of the proceeds will go towards his campaign, a campaign whose fundraising operation is reportedly falling behind Biden's. Frank Luntz is a longtime pollster and political strategist, and he joins us now from Los Angeles. Frank Luntz, it's good to speak with you.
Good to speak with you. And I saw that photograph. It's the first time I've actually seen what the Bible looks like. I don't know how to explain it. I don't know how to defend it.
You going to buy it?
Hell no. I guess I shouldn't say hell no when we're talking about the Bible. But it just, and this is what we're going through as Americans right now. Things that we never believed would be possible. That we thought we would only see in comedies on Saturday Night Live or in the movie theater is actually happening, and it's genuinely serious because it's happening to the United States of America.
Yeah, these are very strange times everywhere, Frank, very strange times in the most powerful, economically, militarily country on earth, and just over 7 months out from that big election. Polls are saying this is going to be a tight race. I mean, what are you seeing? Why is it that way?
I can't imagine us going through it for 7 months. Let's take a look at the positive for Joe Biden. The economy is getting stronger. The unemployment rate is very, very low. American confidence in the future is picking up. He's got issues of border security. He's got issues of the Middle East and China and Ukraine. So there are challenges for him, but domestically it seems to be a good time. For Donald Trump, he's beating Joe Biden on who could best handle inflation, who could best handle the economy, who's the best candidate to secure the border. Those are the positives for Trump. The negatives are also significant. These four major court cases, right. One of them looks like it's going to start in April. It is significant.
How does a candidate with indictments on the table stacked high and trials about to begin maintain a lead over an incumbent president who's a known commodity with a pretty good economy and inflation going in the right direction? I mean, in Canada, I would think all of these criminal charges are automatically disqualifying, but it's kind of invigorating for the Trump campaign, it seems.
Well, two reasons. One is that Trump has perfected the victimization label, and he truly knows every time he gets indicted, his numbers go up. Every time they try to throw him off the ballot, his numbers go up. It's not Donald Trump who's winning this election. It's Joe Biden who is losing it. And every time I say this, I get texted by all sorts of very significant people saying to me, stop saying this. You're hurting Joe Biden's efforts. And it's the truth. Americans look at him. Over 80% think he's too old. Over 70% don't know what he wants to do in the future. Over 60% don't approve of his performances on the two issues that matter most, the economy and immigration. This is not Donald Trump being strong, it's Joe Biden being weak. And make no mistake, we're gonna have the most negative campaign in modern political history, and for every Canadian who's following this, don't. It's gonna depress you, it's gonna anger you. You're gonna build a fence across the northern border of America, your southern border, to keep American politicians and American political consultants out of your country, and you should do it, because this is gonna be awful.
Well, I don't disagree with you. Every indication from up here in Ottawa, but you know how hard it is to ignore America when you're in the suburbs of America, like Canada is? It's pretty tough, right? I mean, but what does it say about the state of things there, Frank, when you're warning us to look away because it's not good for us to watch this, but you have potential criminality as a benefit in an election cycle? And what does that say about just where the country's going?
And you have chaos at our southern border, and it truly is chaos. It's not a political statement. You have Republicans delivering talking points, Democrats delivering talking points. And I know that Canadians have a greater degree of trust and confidence, maybe not in the prime minister, but in the commitment of the government to say what they mean what they say, and do what they say. Canadians are more positive about their democracy than any other Western democracy. And it's fascinating that you're bordering on the country that is least positive about its democracy right now, even though so many countries take the page out of them. I'm concerned that there won't be debates. I'm concerned that there could be political violence. I'm concerned about AI. We haven't even talked about that. What AI is going to do to our political process. And in the end, I'm concerned that China, Russia, Iran will seek to send in misinformation and disinformation and cause some real damage. I wish it were not happening in America. I don't want it to happen to our friends up north as well. But there is one thing we can learn about it, which is that we have to, in the end, it starts in education, starts in our schools, starts with our kids. We have to be able to teach them to be able to define the difference between what is truth and what is fiction. Right. And if we can have an educated electorate, we can survive all of this. But an uneducated electorate that doesn't understand its civil responsibilities, then we have a real problem.
Look, you're not wrong. And this fraying in trust of government and democracy, it's happening here, maybe not at the accelerated rate that you're witnessing, but you're seeing it creep into the conversation. And we do have Elections Canada, which I think we take for granted as Canadians because it brings a stability and a consistency to voting that helps with some of those trust factors. But these are societal challenges we've all got to worry about. But on just the basic mechanics of your election, Trump's money is tied up in all kinds of things, either legal orders and sanctions and properties and whatever. Biden's raking in some cash, and he may break records. So that can be an equalizer in election campaigns because he can buy and spend and organize and poll and do things Trump might not be able to match. Could that tilt things?
You're correct. But and by the way, your questions are right on. They're dead. They're perfect. They're dead on with what's going on. I do want to challenge you in one area. Go back and listen to this interview. The questions that you've asked are not hostile, but they express almost shock that Donald Trump is doing as well as he's doing. And I want to emphasize that the public's belief in the media to present an accurate and fair account of the elections has never been this low. That they don't know where to turn to get the truth because that's the value that they want more than anything else. Republicans watch Republican media, Democrats watch Democratic media, and there isn't enough of that give and take. So I want to emphasize that. I don't want any of your viewers to turn off this show. I want to emphasize that if you lose the sense of trust, if you don't believe you're being told the truth, that is the beginning of the end of democracy. And unfortunately, that is fraying in America. We are starting to distrust what we're being told. So how are we supposed to figure out who to vote for and be confident of that decision? That's another problem that Americans are facing right now.
I agree with you, and we're seeing that here. When I was growing up, there was a common set of facts that all of the media institutions talked about, and now we don't even have a common set of facts, right? We argue over what is true and what isn't, and there is no town square anymore where everybody gathers and has these conversations.
And that's why these interviews are so important. And notice the decibel level between you and I is so calm that we can discuss this. We can acknowledge the strengths and weaknesses of both sides. We can acknowledge the threat to American democracy and even what's going on in Canada. This is not typical of the conversations that are happening in America. We know this. Christmas, Thanksgiving. The one-third of all dinners were disrupted by a political conversation that didn't go well. If we lose our ability to disagree and we lose our willingness to listen to the other side, then we are lost as a country. We're lost as a democracy, and our future is in jeopardy. And that's exactly what I see going forward between now and Election Day.
I just want to ask you one more question. You touched on all of those threats that you're worried about foreign interference. We have a public inquiry happening right now here in Ottawa, not far from where I'm sitting, looking at foreign interference by various hostile actors in Canadian elections. You've outlined the big players, and you're the big target because you're the United States of America. And then you mentioned artificial intelligence. You get a deep fake launched by a hostile actor in this fragmented media ecosystem we have with the acceleration power of social media. How do you think that could hit an election like this? Because we have an election coming up in the next 18 months. I'm terrified by what artificial intelligence and bad actors is going to unleash up here.
You should be. It's the right approach. And by the way, those who ignore it or dismiss it or say that it is not essential, I'm worried about TikTok because TikTok is not providing accurate informative information. It is a biased information. It is tilted and one-sided. And that's where young people under age 25 are getting all their political news. And I'm glad to see that some legislation in America is going to address this. But as the bigger picture, it is why, number one, you have to be willing to challenge the sources of media and get confirmation of what you see and what you hear.
Right.
Number two is you have to be collecting from all sides of the spectrum, and not just television, online, radio, print. We have to get more sources from more diverse points of view. And third, a healthy skepticism is good, but a deep cynicism is awful. And once again, that's where we're headed as a democracy if we're not careful about it.
Frank Luntz, I enjoyed this conversation. I'm not going to say it made me happy, but I'm because the topics are grim. But look, man, we'll have you back anytime. I appreciate this. It's good to have blunt, honest talk about where we are as Western democracies. And we appreciate your input every time you come on. So thanks for joining us today.
And I'm honored to be here. And let's do this face-to-face in studio sometime.
Okay. If you're ever in Ottawa, man, you got an invitation. Thanks so much, Frank. See ya.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochrane. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.